All right, welcome on to a Wednesday edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. Lots of games to talk about tonight. Danny, let's get right into it. I think there were 11, and I think we've got something to say on just about all of them.
We do. So we're starting with Lakers-Orlando going in loose chronological order. And, I mean, you tweeted out Elfrid Payton's shot chart. That's a part of this story. I think the most important part is Victor Oladipo. He got knocked out of the game with concussion-like symptoms. And the guy who ended up taking his mantle was Shabazz Napier, who not only played point guard because C.J. Watson was out, but he also, in the closing lineup, he played shooting guard next to Elfrid Payton.
And I suppose that you are quite rankled by that, considering your Hazonia fandom?
No, I mean, he wasn't missing a shot. If a guy's that hot, you keep him in. I think he was 4 or 5 from three in the fourth quarter. No, I have absolutely no problem with that. You play the guy who brought you there, and I think he's a big part of the reason they won the game.
I don't really know if that's true, by the way, the idea of if a guy's that hot, you should leave him in. We've talked about this a little bit way back when the program started about, you know, do you go with your starters? And granted, with Oladipo out, it makes that decision a little easier. It's not like Hazonia has proven anything yet this year either to where you should have been going with him over Napier. But just as a general proposition, we'll actually get to another example of this too with Giannis only playing 15 minutes, I think, in and missing most of the Bucks' fourth quarter comeback against the Nuggets. Of when you do bring your starters back, whether it's good to go with the sensible hot hand, especially if that hot hand is a bench guy who got hot playing against bench players, I'm not sure, and it's, you know, obviously too long of a question to get into here. There are a lot of factors that can weigh into this on a case-by-case basis, but I definitely don't think that, all right, well, a guy's hot, like, that just means you leave him in, even though I guess you do sort of need a way as a coach to incentivize players who are playing well with the idea that you're going to stay in if you're playing well.
Thank you for making me want to clarify my statement. The reason that I think it in this circumstance is that nobody else had established themselves. I don't think that it was. I don't support it in a situation where a player like Giannis is clearly better, but in a circumstance where Hazonia hasn't really, he didn't really do much in this game. He's in Scal's doghouse, it seems, seemingly regularly, and they just don't have a ton of players who can do that. And having another creator on the floor is a very good thing, especially creator with a jump shot that you have to respect. And this game featured a lot of unusual substitutions and rotations, just like before. And I think one that rankled you, I think, was the last possession, right?
Yeah, we are both quite rankled, it would appear. So here's the Lakers lineup on the last possession. And this is, to be clear, this isn't like an offense-defense line. This is timeout. There's 0.8 seconds on the shot clock, or I'm sorry, 0.8 differential between the shot clock and game clock, I think. And so basically you're going all offense. We're trying to get the best chance to score, run it all the way down, and get what's going to be pretty darn close to the last shot. So they went with Lou Williams, D'Angelo Russell, Nick Young, Meta World Peace, and Roy Hibbert. I have no idea why you would ever have Roy Hibbert out there in a situation where all you need to do is get a bucket. He's not a positive offensive player. He actually was 5 for 8 today, but you're not going to throw it to him. So how does he help at all? And they ended up just pretty much ISOing for Lou Will at the end. And it was very costly that they didn't get a shot because the shot clock expired. If he hits the rim then on that shot, then they just go into overtime. The clock keeps running. But if you miss it, even though the clock expires, they have to reset it back to when the 24-second clock expired. That enabled Orlando to advance the ball and get the game-winning shot to Vucevic, which, you know, I didn't really have any criticisms of how that was handled defensively. I think Vucevic just did a great shot.
Yeah, exactly. I think that there are no criticisms there. I thought it was a decent contest. But, yeah, leaving the time left, and it was, Lou Williams' shot, just it hit only backboard, so it went straight to that. And it wasn't a great shot. You know, it wasn't one of those where it was a near miss or anything like that. It was disappointing. And also, Vucevic was in defensively for that possession as well.
Yeah, that's another one that we've talked about going back to the beginning where Orlando lost a couple of games because they went right at him in pick and roll. But the Lakers, just over the last minute of the game or so, both of their crunch time plays were pretty miserable. Orlando actually got a really nice play with a sweet backdoor cut from Napier that he just wasn't able to finish from Peyton before that. So that was pretty good. Yeah, I mean, Peyton, starting to worry about him a little bit, right? He took basically one shot outside of 8 feet in this game. He took two.
Yeah.
He was 1 for 11 inside of 8 feet. Some of that was Hibbert, but a lot of it even was Hibbert out of the game. And a couple of them were just sort of like missed putbacks or just easy layups that he just flubbed that weren't even the result of any kind of defensive pressure. I mean, he just had a bad game. You can have a bad game finishing two or stuff just doesn't go right for you just the same as you can from three-point range. But just his overall efficiency is becoming a major problem. The fact that he took all those shots in the lane, didn't take any jumpers at all against a team that has a guy in Hibbert who's always going to lay back on the pick and roll a lot. It's concerning, and we've talked about this a lot, how many resources that the organization has invested in him and some of the opportunity costs of other point guards that they may have tried to acquire that they didn't because they believe in him. And it's just not quite working for him yet. Offensively, I'm not saying that it can't, but even though his jumper looks reworked, it looks like this is going to be a years-long project to get him to where he can be an average offensive point guard, and who knows if he even does get there.
Did you end up watching D'Angelo Russell's shots in this game?
Yeah, I did, and because he was, I thought his line was interesting. I didn't watch the game in full. I went back and watched the last few possessions, and then looked at all of his shots and assists. And so his final line was 6 of 15, 3 assists, 3 turnovers. He did have two, I would say, actually really encouraging drives. One where he got great extension on a fast break layup. Although he did score over a Victor Oladipo who had like just been concussed, so you can maybe don't put that too high in his ledger. And then on another great play, he drove right to the basket on Vucevic and actually finished with his right hand through some contact against Vucevic's body. And that's one more right-handed layup than he made the entire year last year at Ohio State. So that was encouraging. Like, he's going to have to get that offhand to be good because he doesn't have the athleticism really to just only finish with one hand and get away with it. So I thought that was encouraging. This game also played to his strengths offensively a little bit because he's mostly a mid-range jump shooter at this point. And with Vucevic hanging back on the pick and roll, he was able to get a lot of shots, which, were okay. I mean, he had 14 points on 15 shots, so still not even an efficient game, but he was at least out there at the end. 3 assists wasn't incredibly encouraging either, although I don't know how many his teammates flubbed necessarily. But yeah, I mean, I thought it was at least a couple of encouraging signs for Russell in a season that hasn't seen many of them so far.
The only other note I have in this game is that Orlando only shot one free throw in the second half, and that was off of Shabazz Napier and one, and that's just concerning, just straight up. Anytime that happens, anytime a team doesn't only shoots one free throw and a half, that's just something to think about.
Channing Frye can still play, by the
way.
What do you know? He was out of the rotation to start the year, and he's had double-figure points, I think, in either the last two or two of the last three games, still draining his threes. Now, they switched a lot of him. He actually had one bucket on a nice Peyton assist where they switched, and he was able to post up against, I think it was Lou Williams or some smaller point guard, which, if he can score on those types of plays, they didn't get killed defensively when he was in there, at least. So, maybe there's some hope for him getting traded to a contender, helping someone as a backup center, because if he can just hold up even remotely defensively, his shooting still is something that can be a major problem for defenses, especially when you're trying to play someone like Hibbert if you're the Lakers.
Yeah, that's definitely a good point. Are you ready to talk Knicks Hornets?
Yes, it is. I really enjoyed this game. Mm-hmm. A lot on both ends. The crunch time was pretty funny. You watched more of it, I think, in the first half than I did. You noted that the Hornets started with PJ Tucker.
Hairston.
No, not Tucker. Hairston. Jeez. Boy, I said Anthony Robertson last night.
You did.
Instead of Andre Robertson, too, which was pretty pathetic as well.
It happens, man. So it's late.
It does. But, it's vexing because when I would listen to podcasts and like Simmons or something would screw up, somebody's hand would be like, oh, how can you do that? But as it turns out, after watching 7 hours of basketball and trying to talk for an hour, it's actually very difficult to avoid screwing up.
Try to broadcast the game. I did that a couple times, and then I totally gained so much more respect for that too, having done that a couple times.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm sure that that's. Wait, when did you broadcast a game? Just like sitting at home, just trying.
No. I did some municipal high school football.
Oh, when was that?
A couple years ago.
Huh. Okay.
I have the tapes.
So were you play by play?
I was color.
With your extensive football background,
hey, I didn't play, but I've watched it for a long time. I used to cover it too.
Okay, all right, fair enough. Yeah. Anyway, I'm sure it is really difficult.
That's
and
brutal.
For as much as we kill all these color announcers for some of the difficult stuff they say, like I respect the job that all of them do because there's no way I could just walk right in and start doing that without any experience. Anyway, that's an aside. What else did you have in this game? Oh yeah, so they started with Harrison on Melo. And Batum on Aflalo, and that is something that they do pretty regularly. Coach Clifford has said that there's the reason for that is he wants to. Batum is important offensively, and they don't want to put him on the toughest guy. And also, I think against a guy like Melo, Harrison's big body actually can be a little bit more effective. Melo has been lighting up guys, and Melo had a good game, but he has been lighting up guys like Otto Porter and Batum when Batum was on him in this game. Who are pretty skinny, and you know, I think he's got the ability to kind of get guys off him with his body a little bit, or get a little bit of a step on him, and then you know, get the shoulder into him as well, and get to the basket. So I do like guys who are a little bit stronger on Melo.
Yeah, there were two really kind of fascinating substitution things that the Knicks did in this game. One was, as we expected, Sasa Vujicic just missed. He didn't play at all. He went from a starter to a DNP. And that
excellent. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
By the way,
and
good for
and
them.
And so the thing that they did that I thought was so interesting is that they did what a lot of teams do when they had their backups in for the end of the first and the beginning of the second. But what they did is they kept the perimeter guys the same. So it was Thomas, Galloway, and Grant. But they switched the interior guys. So it was Amundsen and Kylo Quinn at the end of the first, and then the beginning of the second it was Serafin and Derek Williams. Amundsen and O'Quinn and that lineup did pretty well, and then Serafin and Williams just got murdered. And some of that was because Williams had two of the worst turnovers of the year. There was one where he basically lost his ability to pay attention to anything while the ball was in his hands. And so Lynn stole it, and they got an easy bucket the other way. And I just thought that was interesting because there was a dichotomy in the way that it looked. And also, I think just in terms of help defense and a lot of other things, I think the Derek Williams-Serafin combination just isn't the best matchup of skills and weaknesses.
Yeah, unless there's some massive post guy on the other team, why are you playing O'Quinn or why are you playing Serafin over O'Quinn anyway? O'Quinn has been pretty good to start the year.
Yeah, he also tried to pass the ball once and it was horrendous. It reminded me of why he never passed.
The dribble handoff went awry.
Went awry, it went straight up.
Yeah, Coach Nick find that one for us.
Yeah.
It will be interesting to see too. Now that Galloway has established himself as being a pretty good player, that maybe, but they also want to get Porzingis out there. So it'll be interesting to see whether they go with Calderon, Galloway, Aflalo maybe at the three, Carmelo at the four, which is his best offensive position, and then maybe you go with either Porzingis or Lopez. You could also just dump Calderon and go with a little bit more defense. Galloway in the triangle, you don't need like a pure point guard. If he's going to keep shooting like this, he can absolutely play that point guard position, and he's better defensively than Calderon is, and then you can still play Porzingis and Lopez together. You had your note in here that Marvin Williams was getting lit up by Porzingis at one point.
Well, yeah, it's a physical difficulty that Marvin Williams has because Porzingis just the term I've liked to use is ball racking. Like he could basically just shoot over him and he couldn't do anything about it. But what was more surprising was when there were a couple times where Porzingis was backing into him and actually kind of bullying Marvin Williams. It was the first time in a while that I've seen Porzingis actually do that to somebody, and it was encouraging because I don't know, I always like that. The other Porzingis factors we talked, I think it was over the weekend, about how he's done such a great job offensive rebounding, and in this game, he had 15 boards, but only two of them were offensive. The other 13 were defensive rebounds.
Yeah, I'm just very impressed by his energy.
Absolutely.
And the type of shape that he's in. His pursuit rate on offensive rebounds is very high. I'd be interested to see what Seth's statistics say about that. And his jumper kind of waxes and wanes. I still don't think that he's a guy, although he hit a couple of shots on Marvin Williams, ultimately only finished 5 out of 10. I still don't think that he is a guy who you're going to go to for his own individual offense. There are also a couple of plays in this game where he would run a pick and roll with Melo or with Calderon or someone else, and it would have been so easy for him to just pop to the top for a three-pointer. And I'm pretty sure that he's not being instructed to do that. He's being instructed to roll hard at the rim, which he does a good job of, as Amin and I talked about a couple of days ago. But you also just have Robin Lopez standing right there, and he's just rolling right into where Lopez is and where his man is. And so he's not really able to catch the ball and do much there. And so that means that things are kind of gummed up. I wish that they would run more pick and pop with him, especially for three-pointers. That's something that he did in Europe and was effective at, but that's just not something that seems part of the philosophy so far. I think especially if he's playing the four, it would be good to see more of that from him. He only had one three-point attempt today.
The end of the game was really exciting, and so it ended up being that there was a how much time was left on the there was a baseline out of bounds with
right. So well, we should talk about the possession that preceded that true. First, which was was it tied at that point where when Melo they did the Melo isolation?
Yes, I believe it was.
Yeah, it was tied at 93, and they actually had Marvin Williams on Melo for that last possession, and they tried to iso Melo on him. Melo actually like made him fall down and got a pretty good shot, but unfortunately that hit the side of the backboard. And then again, because there was a shot clock violation, Charlotte was able to advance the ball. Hawes threw, Seth said it wasn't that good of an inbounds pass. I didn't think it was that bad, but they ran a nice flare option to the weak side, like similar to some of the stuff that Randy Whitman has been running late game, but it got broken up. They actually had Batum open for a second, and then so they got a baseline out of bounds with about 2 seconds left, and then things went awry for the Knicks.
They definitely did, and Robin Lopez, it seemed like he just lost Cody Zeller. There was kind of a little bit of a scuttlebutt around the rim. He lost Cody Zeller. Cody Zeller put the ball in, and so then there was only about, it ended up being 6 tenths.
Point six.
It ended up being 6 tenths of a second.
Remaining.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, so on that play, basically what it was is Zeller was standing on the left block opposite of where they're inbounding on the baseline. And Jeremy Lin, the play was for Jeremy Lin to receive a screen from Zeller going to the middle of the court, and Lopez helped on that screen. And all probably would have been okay if he had then reacted to kind of get in between the pass and Zeller. But instead, he just kind of reacted back to where Zeller was. Kind of what you need to do in that situation is, and you look ridiculous doing it as a player, but you basically just have to turn your head constantly like a chicken, essentially, like, and make sure that you always have an idea as often as you can, getting a position fix on where your man is and the guy that you're helping out on. And he lost sight of Zeller, and so when he turned around, he went back to where he thought Zeller was. Zeller had then started cutting along the baseline to receive the pass, and then it was too late. They got the pass. Melo also could have helped there by shading under the basket. He was guarding the inbounder, Batum. He probably was worried about Batum receiving a screen and getting the ball back. So maybe, you know, because if you shade towards the basket, you put yourself in a more difficult position to get that. But I still think he could have done that a little bit. And so that's how you give up a game-winning layup on a baseline out of bounds, which is about as embarrassing as it gets.
And it almost was not a game-winning layup because they ended up putting, it was at 4 tenths, I think, and then they put it back up to 6 tenths. Porzingis got, I think, as clean a look as you could expect in that situation, and the ball was just barely in his fingers when it ended up expiring.
Well, yeah, and this was horrible defense by the Hornets.
Yep.
They basically just let Porzingis catch the ball and shoot a wide open three, which anyone who knows anything about Porzingis can know that he can hit that shot. And I said beforehand that he was a perfect guy to throw it to in that situation because he's tall enough to get his shot off. But Clifford actually said after the game he took the responsibility because he said he thought he knew what play they were running and told Cody Zeller, basically to help on Melo. He thought it looked like it was going to be a lob to Melo, and then Porzingis instead just popped out, and no one was able to get to him at all. I mean, you could see Zeller came off onto Melo and basically was going towards the basket. Marvin Williams tried to react out, and just Porzingis couldn't quite get it out of his hands quickly enough. But I mean, I think in that situation, your number one goal is don't give up a three and lose the game when you're up two.
Agreed.
All right, anything else on that game? Should we move on?
Do you want to talk about Kemba and Al Jefferson shooting a combined?
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. I mean, neither of those guys closed the game. It was, and I like Zeller at center, especially defensively. He's just very active and can beat a lot of centers with his movement, as he actually did on that final play, both setting picks, rolling to the rim. His shooting becomes a little bit more of a weapon. And Al Jefferson and Kemba were combined, I think, 4 out of 21 in this game, and that's why they didn't close the game. And they had Marvin Williams playing the 4, and that was really Lamb also, I think, had another good game, right?
I believe he did, yeah. He had
Yeah, 6 out of 10 for 14 points.
Yeah, 6 out of 10 for 14, and 4 rebounds, which I always think is good for a guy like him, and 2 steals. They had so many steals in this game.
They
had 11.
Yeah, that's a lot of steals against a Knicks team that plays at a relatively slow pace. I don't think of them as a particularly
So they scored 25 points off turnovers. The Knicks scored 4. That's a pretty big split.
You know what else is interesting? Lou Amundsen actually had more minutes than Kyle O'Quinn did in this game. And Derek Williams, who is an early season darling, 4 minutes. Serafin, 2 minutes. Yeah, and as you noted, Serafin, Derek Williams was negative 12 in his 4 minutes, and Serafin was negative 7 in his 2 minutes and 34 seconds. So, yeah, the numbers do, in fact, back up your statement that that was not a particularly effective combination.
One could even say it was disastrous.
All right, should we get to this Dallas Clippers game and my continuing mea culpa about thinking that Dirk might be kind of done this year? That is incorrect. He's been kicking ass so far.
Absolutely. It makes me just happy to see him doing it at this level and, you know, into the season. So we're past the aberration phase now.
Are we? When does the aberration phase officially end?
It depends on the player. It depends on the situation. I mean, I think that it in a situation like him, where there's more precedent, you can do that. But yeah, if it's a young guy, I like to say 2 months.
Yeah, that's a good point too, and especially if it's, you know, he doesn't have an established track record of shooting the way that Dirk does. I thought actually the big heroes in this game though were defensively for the Mavs. Wes Matthews guarded Chris Paul pretty much the whole time, held him to 2 of 11. He did have 11 assists, but, you know, and Paul also is, I think, working his way back from that groin strain that he suffered against the Warriors. He was really good in that game, has been pretty bad other than that. Wes was also 9 out of 13 in this game, 3 of 4 on threes, was abusing guys in the post. He had 25 points, and he shut down Paul. I mean, what a game from him, and the fact that he's able to have a game like this, even though there were times when it looked like he wasn't quite getting the lift that he expected to on, like, some hook shots coming across the lane and stuff, you know, just having that kind of a game coming off the torn Achilles this early, I didn't expect anything like that. And, you know, 33 minutes from him, too.
Does it concern you at all that they were able to play Matthews on Paul as much as they did, but they still had Deron Williams play 32 minutes, Felton play 30, and Harris play 26? And they couldn't, and the Clippers couldn't exploit that, basically having point guards on their other guys.
Well, who's going to exploit?
Exactly. I mean, but that's why.
Well, also, I guess actually, Redick was heated up early, and he had 10 points on 6 shooting possessions, but he only played 14 minutes because his back locked up on him, and he's struggled with back spasms throughout his career in these last few years. So that's a concern as well. You have to imagine he's probably going to miss some time now. I mean, with Lance Stephenson, you know, I know Austin Rivers had an okay game. I mean, 16 points on 14 shooting possessions, 2 of 6 on threes, and was okay defensively. But ultimately, I mean, giving up $118 to this Dallas team, that's just not good enough for the Clippers.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't watch a ton of this game, but that's actually, to me, what was more lingering was that I was a little bit more concerned with them than I was impressed with Mavericks, and that is no slight to Dallas. They played a good game, but I just, when you think about the Clippers, when I always am drawn to the team that I think has more potential that season, and I think it said a little bit more about them.
Yeah, I mean, Dirk's night, 31 points on 14 shots, and then 4 or 5 from the line. Pretty remarkable what he was able to do. And granted, the Clippers don't have a great guy to guard him. He was 5 of 6 on threes, and that's something that I think, especially his release looked faster on those threes. He was able to get them off. He, you know, he had 4 buckets from his favorite spot on the left block where he was going to the Dirk fade. I think when you've got him in the post, you really want to try and make him turn left shoulder so he can't go to that move. That's the one move now is his athleticism has waned that he knows feels like, you know, unless he's being guarded by AD or something, that he feels like he can get that shot off every time. So I think your number one goal in guarding him is to take that away and make him kind of put the ball on the floor and be a driver going to his right. But that's obviously easier said than done. He's one of the all-time greats. I mean, and the fact that he could score 31 points and make one shot in the restricted area is just ridiculous to me.
It is. And the other thing that made this game unusual.
11 of 14, and only one of the makes was a layup. That's ridiculous.
Wow. And one of the other things that made this game distinct to me is that the Clippers starters, obviously it was different because of J.J. Redick missing time. They were all pretty solid negatives, and their bench were almost all pretty solid positives.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I think
DeAndre was negative 23 in this game, a team worst. The intentional fouling, he was 3 of 9. That got Doc to take him out of the game in the fourth quarter. There's actually a hilarious incident where Doc stole a possession for DeAndre because Carlisle sent in Salah Mejri just basically to foul DeAndre. And so then Doc pretended like he was putting in Pierce to take out DeAndre. Carlisle sent Mejri back, and then Doc sent Pierce back. And so they got an extra possession, which apparently, according to courtside observers, Carlisle laughed at that and congratulated Doc for getting one over on him. But ultimately, I mean, Carlisle won the war. He got them to take DeAndre out, and then they got smashed on the offensive glass. You know, it was the Pierce-Blake-Griffin front court, and that's just not going to stop anybody.
Yeah, and as we talked about at length during the playoffs, the goal of Hacka is to get that player out of the game.
Zaza Pachulia also had a wonderful defensive game against Griffin. You would hope that this is one of those games where Blake, with his mobility and his jump shot, could take advantage against a guy like Pachulia because he still doesn't quite have the strength or the length, maybe even more importantly, to really bully inside against centers the way he can against power forwards. Do you think that, you know, it's kind of his face-up game would be a little bit better? I would like to actually see Blake develop more of a triple threat game off the catch where he turns and faces. Now that he has this jump shot, with his level of quickness, I'd like to see him be able to turn and face, get guys with jab steps, get them off and either shoot the jump shot or get them up on them and drive by in a straight line drive. I think especially when the other teams guard him with centers the way they did with Pachulia because they just had Dirk on DeAndre Jordan when he was in. That would be the way for him to combat that, but he wasn't really able to be effective. Only 8 out of 19 in this game, and only 3 assists, too, which is you expect to see more of from him.
One really small thing at an insignificant part of the game that stuck out to me was on, I think it was the last possession of the game, they were just kind of putzing around, and Justin Anderson came from basically the free throw line, came all the way back and blocked a shot on the last possession of the game, and it was more burst and lift from him than, I mean, he's never been a bad athlete, it's nothing like that, but I was like, oh yeah, I can remembering that he has that kind of capability in him.
Yeah, last point on this, Chandler Parsons asked if the DeAndre drama is done. His quote was, "He's not a priority to us, and by the looks of their team, he's not to them either." Which, given the fact that Doc took him out because of the fouling, you know, maybe they kind of rankles a little bit. Gosh, we've really been saying that a lot. All right, what else we got today?
Oh, it was a fun day of games. So we could talk about the Sixers. We do briefly on the Sixers.
Yeah. Do a couple of quick hitters here. Yeah, I watched most of the that was whatever game is always on first at 4 o'clock Pacific. I usually end up getting sucked into. And I made the joke that especially with Noel out and with Covington out for the Sixers, I'd be watching a lot of Sixers first halves and not very many Sixers second halves, both because of the start time, but also because the game is usually totally out of hand. And Toronto blew them out in the third quarter. Jahlil Okafor was awesome offensively. He was schooling Biombo, schooling Valanciunas. He really is a very unique player who surprises a lot of guys who aren't ready for him because he'll make a move, put the ball on the floor, and although he doesn't really sky, he's very quick off the floor, and he'll get a floater up over guys before they even realize that the ball has been released and they can't block it, and his touch on those plays is so soft that he was really dominating offensively in the first half, but he was every bit as bad defensively in this game as he was offensively. And just, I sort of live tweeted it for like 5 or 6 possessions where he basically either failed to get over and help defense and gave up a layup, or gave up an offensive rebound on like 5 or 6 straight possessions in the second
quarter. And like on the last one of those, because I flipped over once I saw you were live tuning it, I think he bit on a pump fake unnecessarily and then drew, and then the guy got 2 fouls.
DeRozan, yeah. That's right. I mean, I tweeted that that was progress for him because at least he got over there to foul. And I do think that, there are a couple of aspects with this. The hope, I think, was that he was going to be able to play less minutes and they're going to bring him along, trust the process, blah, blah. But, despite all of his limitations, on a lot of nights, he's the only hope they have for offense. So Braun is still trying to win games. He wants to get some scoring. So he's got to leave Jahlil out there for maybe more minutes than he'd like to. I think if you were playing less minutes, both you would have the carrot of more playing time to get him to defend, and also you'd have more energy to do so. But now, he just isn't able to do that. And I do think that when he actually gets there and really tries to move and is locked in, he has quick enough feet to get there. He's got a big body if he can get his chest in front of people. And he also has pretty quick hands to kind of get a few of those Tim Duncan type of blocks without ever leaving the ground, just sort of knocking it out of guys' hands as they go up. So I think he still has the tools to get there, but something's going to have to change because he's just not executing at this point.
We can do another quick hitter on the Pacers beating the Celtics kind of by 11 points at the Garden. And
another really nice win for the Pacers, by the way.
Absolutely, and another really nice game for one Paul George.
Yeah, he now in his last 4 games, 30 points a game, 9 rebounds, 5 assists, 2 steals, 48% from the field, 45% on threes. That's remarkable work, and that's really getting to the level. I don't think he's quite as athletic as he was, but he's also 2 years older, so that's kind of a reason for that. But his jump shot looks every bit as good. Now, he also had a very hot run of shooting early on in that 2013-14 season when people were talking about him as an MVP. So, we'll need to dig into his stats a little bit more on how he's doing it. Maybe we can do that that'll be my contribution for the 30 and 60 next week. But to see how much of that is just unsustainable jump shooting. But still, just the fact that he's having these type of games and to see how he looked when he came back for those 6 games at the end of last year, really awesome to see that he is doing this well. All right.
I have one other note.
Please.
Candace Buckner of the Indy Star reported that Miles Turner has a fracture in his hand. I believe it's his left thumb and he's going to be evaluated. So hopefully everything's okay.
Yeah. You have to imagine if he has a fracture in his thumb, that's like a month injury or so, which is too bad because A, they need him. They just need any big who has a heartbeat right now. And number 2, he'd been playing really well and having a very encouraging season to start with. So that's too bad. We really had a ton of injuries, which we can kind of round up at the end of the night.
Do I go to the Spurs?
Let's save that for last. We'll do a couple of these other kind of quick hitter ones. Let's do New Orleans, Atlanta. AD didn't play in this game, so you thought that New Orleans didn't have much of a chance. They actually were tied up to about maybe 8 minutes to go or so, and then the Hawks bench was able to widen out the lead and ultimately won somewhat comfortably. But it was a second straight encouraging game for New Orleans after a win yesterday. They blew out Dallas. They're on the road without AD. They have all their other injuries as well. And to just play well against a Hawks team that's been playing pretty decently, I think they at least seem to have righted the ship to the point where you're not thinking now, all right, what is wrong with these guys? Are they ever going to turn it around? Do they have serious problems? These last two games at least have shown that they are capable of playing some good basketball. And I think, you know, if AD were there for this game, and he has a hip contusion, I think he's going to be out for a little bit, but not, you know, maybe a couple games or so. Maybe he'll be back next game. So that's encouraging. For the Hawks, my biggest note on this was Al Horford, 4 of 6 on threes, all 6 of which were above the break threes, a lot of them taken out of pick and pop. That now is going to be a major weapon if he's shooting those above the break threes like that.
Awesome. Just I'm such a big
And he just supporter. Added that this
yeah,
year.
He didn't do that at all last year.
Yeah, I mean he shot a few from the corner. I think he only made like 20 threes all year, but he would take a few in the corners. But now just being able as your center, and then the other guy is Millsap too. I mean, so, you know, if you have a big lumbering center now, you got to have your center guard either a guy who's going to take threes out of pick and pop from the top of the key or guard Paul Millsap off the dribble and on his three-pointers, which is not – he probably won't shoot as high a percentage as Horford just because he's kind of more of a 34-35% guy. But still, like, that is just not a good matchup when you have these kind of behemoths. And it'd be interesting to see, you know, where the Cavs go matching up with them. Obviously, the guarding LeBron is always going to be a problem for the Hawks. But now they can at least maybe get Mozgov off the court, force him to go to Thompson. Maybe they have to go small. And then you have a little bit more of an advantage with someone like Millsap or Horford inside if you get him to go small.
Yeah. Ready to move on to Denver-Milwaukee?
Yeah, this is a game I did not expect to see a ton of, but it sort of ended up in that like mountain time zone window when there wasn't a ton going on in the other games. Milwaukee's, after giving up 34 points in the third quarter to Denver, which for an ostensibly good defensive team like Milwaukee should not happen to this Denver team that really does not have a ton of offensive options or shooting. But then they fought their way back. And they actually managed to take the lead. Jared Bayless had an unbelievable fourth quarter, just getting out on fast break layups, hitting threes, getting to the basket. Denver's defense was not very good on him. You know, he's not some unbelievable finisher, but he was just driving past dudes. So he was fantastic. And Jason Kidd, as he will often do, stayed with a unit that was working well. I mean, he did this a lot last year when the bench was playing so well in the first half of the year. And, you know, he wouldn't bring back guys like Jabari or Giannis. Now, though, and he went with Johnny O'Brien at the 4. Monroe was at the 5. Then they had Vasquez and Bayless in the backcourt with Middleton at the 3. And that lineup did really well. It got them back in the game. Obviously, he was dissatisfied with the way the guys played in the 3rd to give up 34 points. But I think at some point it would have been nice to come back with Giannis, even though, of course, right as I tweeted that, O'Brien hit like a 2-point jump shot to give them the lead.
A deep 2-point jump shot.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was probably like a 20-footer spotting up. So he definitely played well, but I think Giannis is just so much better of a player, especially when the other team has Gallinari out there and you would like to have Giannis guard him. I think Giannis did have 5 fouls, so maybe that was kind of why he left him out for longer, but then just never went back to him. They probably could have used Giannis on the last possession of the game, however, when they gave up an offensive rebound.
The Kobe assist of the year?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
Gallinari was unquestionably shooting that. But it was a perfect pass. It was a better pass than any pass could have been.
Yeah, and actually, I got a little bit ahead of myself because Milwaukee did have a nice play towards the end. I asked their beat guy, C.F. Gardner, to ask Kidd about this. He said it wasn't quite designed, but it almost looked like it was. And this is actually, I think, something that teams could do a lot more often just in play design we see that, like, driving to the baseline and doing a hammer screen to the corner is something that teams have done a lot, and just driving, because usually people won't drive unless you think, all right, there's a chance I can make a shot here, right? But if you say the instruction is, like, consider, like, you're getting ice on a pick and roll, for example, right? If you tell the guy, all I want you to do is just dribble under the basket, and we know that you're going to dribble under the basket, so we're going to actually do a play where we're timing cuts to come down the lane as you're doing that, and you're going to know exactly where those guys are going to be, that could be an effective way to kind of deal with that strategy sometimes, where usually guys will be like, all right, the big is there, I have nowhere to go. So, all right, just all you got to do is just get along the baseline. Like, that is your goal. You're not trying to score. You're just trying to move the defense and get a passing angle to a guy coming down the lane. And that's kind of what they actually did. Giannis was able to come in from the opposite corner. I don't think it was necessarily designed, but he was able to come right in and get a layup.
On the only possession I think he was in the entire end of that game.
Yeah, you know, I may have to take it back. I think he might have been in at the end. But two other people who were in were Grievous Vasquez and Greg Monroe, and they were the ones who basically kind of combined to give up the offensive rebound at the end. It was an ISO for Gallo, which he's usually pretty good at, but Monroe properly came over to the near side block as Gallo started into his move and fixed it so that he kind of had to settle for a really tough jump shot. Monroe then tried to get back to Faree but didn't have the quickness to do so and wasn't able to get off the ground and actually jump for the rebound. Meanwhile, Vasquez was on the weak side, and he at first, when Gallo went into his move, went to box out Faree and then thought that a pass was going to take place. He tried to scramble back to his own man way in the weak side three-point line, which was, I don't know why he did that, because that would have been a hell of a pass from Gallo, and Faree was right at the rim, and then Faree was able to get an easy tip and completely not boxed out at all. And you would have liked to see maybe John Henson in there with more mobility, shot blocking than Monroe. You would have liked to have seen them put in maybe someone who's a little bit better defensively than Vasquez, who is not a good defender. So, yeah, disappointing from Kidd that on a defensive stop possession when you're up one, that you wouldn't just put your best defenders in the game, regardless of whether this other unit has gotten you back into it or not.
Right, it ties back into the Orlando Lakers game we talked about earlier. The other thing that made me happy in this was Moutier hit two huge free throws, which always makes me happy when a teenage guy, young guy, can do that.
Yeah, he's shooting 65% going into tonight's play from the line, which is better than he shot in China. His free throw shooting has always been a bugaboo for him and was a reason why I think some people worried about his jump shot. He's shooting well on threes, not good on twos, as we've talked about. So, you know, at least his free throw shooting is a little better. He hit a couple of clutch free throws actually the other night as well.
And his turnover, we talked about that early in the season. He had 11 turnovers in the first game. He's gotten that pretty much under wraps. I mean, you never know if that's a permanent thing, but so in the last...
Yeah, he's all the way down to like 4.5 a game now, but obviously that first game was...
Yeah, I mean, but so the last four games, it's 3, 4, 2, and then 1 tonight. So 11 assists, 1 turnover, that's, you know, that you're not going to do that every night, but it's good to see him do it at least once.
Yeah, and he's a guy who I trust to adjust pretty quickly to the athleticism. I think that that's just something that all guards do. We talked about his finishing at the rim, especially how that takes an adjustment period for everyone, but especially someone like him who's used to just plowing through guys and being more athletic than everyone. Let's talk Brooklyn-Houston. This is the big upset of the night. Brooklyn gets their first win against a full-strength Houston team. Obviously very disappointing. Someone noted that when Terrence Jones plays, the Rockets are now, I think, 1-3, and they are 4-0 when he does not play. I don't know how much this I would blame on him. I don't know. Did you catch any of this game at all?
All I caught was the Bogdanovich dagger three, which was strangely amusing. And then the vine of that really weird passing sequence early in the game. But in terms of actually watching it, the only play I watched was kind of the play that ended up deciding the game.
Yeah, and that play, which, I mean, they ended up winning by quite a bit, but it was that three that really got them out of contact and forced Houston into foul mode. Joe Johnson, ISO Joe, I think the term ISO Joe was even used by the announcer, which was great. And so Harden had him pretty well contained, and then I think Lawson dug down from the top off of Jared Jack, which I'm all right with. Jared Jack is not really a three-point shooter, but then Ariza also, for some reason, was guarding Boyan in the opposite corner and came into the lane also helping and just left Boyan wide open for a three, and Joe found him, and that was pretty much it. Thomas Robinson had a nice little revenge game, although I think half of the games that he plays are revenge games, given how many teams that he's been on. But he actually protected the rim really nicely and athletically as the Nets were kind of making their run back into it. He had a breakaway dunk as well, so it was good to see him get some positive minutes against his former team. And obviously, every bit of energy and athleticism the Nets can get. And Shane Larkin also had a nice game for them, hitting some threes. The big part of this game was, I think Houston was 8 out of 33 on threes, and the Nets were like 8 out of 19. So that was, you know, I think a lot of it was Houston just missing shots. It's not like they were taking terrible shots in this game. And Harden also did not shoot particularly well. You would hope that he could have a better game against a team that doesn't really have that great of a perimeter stopper. Rondé didn't play that much. Boyan actually started the second half because he was having a really good game.
Something that was unusual, just looking at the box score in this game, is Shane Larkin, small guy, 8 rebounds, and Bogdanovich had 9. So you had two backup guards that combined for 17 rebounds, which is, I mean, Bogdanovich played starter minutes in this game, but that's really rare. And the Rockets, you know, they're a team that we usually like to think that they can rebound it solidly enough, but not in this game.
Yeah, the Nets actually really out-rebounded the Rockets a lot. How many second chance points did they have in this game? I think it was like 30 or something, right?
It might have been around there. I don't have the second chance points, but they had 20 offensive rebounds.
Oh yeah, that's crazy. Let's see, I just got it up. Wait, do they not have it on this? Yeah, they do. 33 second chance points for the Nets. The Rockets had 66 points in the paint still, despite the 33 second chance points for the Nets. Although second chance points don't always have to be obviously in the paint, because you could throw it out for a three or something. Harden, 3 out of 10 on threes, 8 out of 22, and the Nets did a great job of keeping him off the line, only 5 free throw attempts. So it's rare that you'll see Harden 23 points on 24 shooting possessions. So he actually less points in shooting possessions is pretty rare for him. Lawson, another pretty ugly game for him, 3 out of 11. He's shooting like 35% so far, not making a great adjustment so far.
Well, and what's so kind of captivating about the Rockets going super duper small like they've been doing is that they have capable big men. I mean, even with Terrence Jones being a little bit limited and Demo not playing, Harrell had a DNP, Capella played a total of 11 minutes. I mean, those guys can handle it. And when your team is getting walloped on the offensive rebounds, seems like you'd at least consider it.
Yeah, Terrence Jones played 15 minutes. I think he took some of Capella's minutes and was not effective. Capella was 4 out of 5 in his 10 minutes, and Jones was 0 for 3 in his 16 minutes. So that's something to watch there as well, especially. And Howard was awesome, actually, in this game. He had 20 and 17, 7 offensive rebounds, 5 blocks. But still, for this Houston team, giving up a buck 6 to the Nets, a team that had really, really been struggling. And Howard actually also helped limit Brook Lopez's 6 out of 17. But despite Howard's game, there's really was a struggle for them defensively. This is a bad, bad Nets offense that put up a buck 6 on them. All right, what else we got? I actually didn't expect to talk about that game that much.
Pistons Kings, DeMarcus Cousins running roughshod over Drummond.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Cousins had 23 in the first half, I think 4 three-pointers, which, and I mean, it's always a conundrum, well, not always, but Detroit wasn't really able to make the Kings pay offensively for running out those two center lineups. And I think at one point, Detroit was like 8 out of 28 on threes, despite a lot of them being wide open. KCP, after that awesome game that we talked about last night against the Warriors, really regressed. He shot poorly, wasn't that good defensively either. He lost. He wasn't as locked in kind of on the weak side without like just a, you know, laser focus on one guy the way he was with Curry. He let like James Anderson get loose for a couple of three-pointers for no real reason a few times. Rondo, interesting game. Do you think he had a triple-double? He played all 48 minutes for the second straight game because Seth Curry and Collison are both out with injuries. Do you think he played a good game? Can we say that? I mean, is anyone even allowed to give Rondo credit anymore? And I'm not saying that he necessarily should. He had like a ton of record scratches in this game too.
He had some good. He definitely had some good moments in this game. I think that there was a stretch. I didn't watch a ton of it, but there was a stretch early on when he was. I think he was doing a good job creating for people. But what this team has a problem sometimes of. I feel like it's forgetting where their bread is buttered. There was a stretch in the. I think it was late in the third. Might have been early in the fourth, where Cousins touched the ball twice on like six possessions, and he was in the game. And it was Gay and Rondo just chucking bad shots and. Yeah, they were still ahead, and that was part of what led the Pistons got to, I think it was 8 points at that point. And what it was just frustrating to me is, it's like, Cousins had this masterful game. He was doing so well against Drummond, and they were just doing their thing. They were freelancing, and that just makes me mad. I mean, because when if it's a game when Cousins isn't doing it, that's something else. But when he has 33 points, and when he's just mystifying Andre Drummond and everybody else on the Pistons, you feed the man. You give the man the ball, and they weren't doing that for stretches, and coincidentally, that's when they were starting to seed some of the ground that they had worked so hard to build.
Yeah, Rondo did have 5 turnovers in this game. He also had one of the worst assist hunting moments that I've seen in the last couple of years, where he just had a fast break layup and decided to throw a behind the back pass to poor Omri Caspi for no reason, even though like the guy who was behind him was like by like 5 steps, and he decided to throw it back to Caspi anyway instead of just shooting a wide open layup. I still think he was not particularly efficient. I mean, he was a +9, but that was lower than most of the other starters. But he played all 48 minutes too, which is pretty remarkable in this game. Ben McLemore, 2 minutes and 57 seconds of playing time, and he. His only box score contribution was a personal foul.
So he avoided the trillion.
Yeah, and really surprising to me, too, when you consider that it's not like they were going with any 2 point guard lineups, right? Like,
no, they were going with 1 point guard, 1 48-minute point guard.
Yeah, I mean, and Marco Bellinelli wasn't fantastic in this game. He was 2 out of 7.
James Anderson
Caspi played 27 minutes. Caspi played 27 minutes, I think like those guys have both been playing pretty well, but yeah, I don't know. I was this McLemore thing, and should we get into like some of those reports that came out about the Kings today?
If you want to, it's your show.
Well, so basically, and please fill in anything. I'm going from memory here. Anything that I'm forgetting?
Okay.
Cousins had like a cursing, like screaming bout at George Karl. At one point.
After the previous game.
Yeah. Then there was supposed to be a players only meeting, which turned into Divots and Mike Bratz going to, and this is all reported, we don't know whether it's true or not, going into the locker room and asking the players whether they wanted George Karl to be fired or not, which is, I've never heard of anything like that happening before, if that's actually true. I think that was reported by the Big Lead.
Correct.
I mean that's and then they just sort of sent Caron Butler and Omri Caspi out to face the media afterwards. And then they had another meeting after which the air was kind of cleared, and they obviously played better against a Pistons team that had been doing pretty well, even though they finished 9 out of 32 on with a lot of open threes. So I don't know. I mean, people talk about all this stuff, and Kevin Arnovitz, who can be very sage on these matters, said, look, it always starts at the top, right? Like, that there's instability. There are also a lot of reports of, like, Vivek really has all these connections with Calipari in Kentucky. They went out to play in Lexington for a exhibition game and were there for a few days. Drake came out. That supposedly is a Kentucky connection there. Vivek really wants to like make a splash and hire Calipari, and that could be, Calipari's not going to come unless he has personnel control and he gets paid just an absolute crap ton. I mean, I think it'd take probably $10 million a year or something to get him to leave Kentucky, where he has the best job in college basketball, and he's king of the castle and being a ton of money. I don't know. Did I miss any of the details here at all?
One thing I want to note, because I made a comment about Calipari felt like the end game to me, and part of that was snark, but part of it wasn't. And people had said, oh, well, he wouldn't take that job. And as somebody who's followed Calipari's career, he would take that job for the right amount of money. That's just the way that it works. I mean, it's not like Memphis had an established basketball tradition when he took that job. You know, that's not a criticism.
Well,
anyway,
but he also, at that point, he was kind of persona non grata, right? I mean, he had NCAA violations at UMass, and he got kicked out of the league with the Nets, right? I mean, so he can't. I think that was the best he could do at that point.
Maybe.
And obviously, you would think that, and he's just a master recruiter, he's much more likely to be successful at Kentucky than Sacramento, and it's way harder to be successful in Sacramento, both because of the fact that the NBA is just harder than college basketball is when you're a master recruiter, and also just because, you know, I think he's just a better coach in college, and there's also all the instability in the organization. That's another thing that he would kind of have to deal with. So, yeah, it would take a lot more money than he's making at Kentucky. And then, you know, the boosters in Kentucky might always just come up and match it. And I think certainly if you're a college coach, you always want to encourage little rumors that you might go elsewhere, because then you can kind of get an adjustment in your contract. it doesn't hurt anything to have those rumors out there. But anyway, I don't know. We're probably getting into too much conjecture at this point,
the only other thing I want to say on Calipari is I wouldn't be surprised if at some point in his career he felt the urge to take another NBA job, because guys just I think that people who are as competitive as he is don't want to have their entire legacy be what his is there. But at the same time, he has the best job in college basketball, so it's a different decision for him than other guys in kind of a similar boat who maybe had one unsuccessful run and maybe would want to try it again.
Yeah, I would say the opposite, just because if he's competitive, he likes winning, and he is winning, and he's going to go somewhere where he's less likely to win, so maybe not.
Yeah,
but I don't
know.
We're not in his head.
Thankfully.
Let's move on. Golden State-Memphis. I didn't see a ton of this game, but a few things just worth noting. Steph had 5 steals in this game. He hit just some amazing shots. If you haven't looked at the vines of those, please do. For Memphis, Conley was 1 out of 12 from the field. He has not played well at all so far this year. And it's interesting because the calculus for his new contract is almost easier in a way if he plays well, because then it's just, all right, we're just going to max him out, 5-year deal, he stays easy. Now, if he sort of has really struggles this year and looks like last year might have been a career year and he's a little on the downside, then you start to wonder, what is his value? You might have some other teams coming in, especially if Memphis doesn't play that well this year, maybe they're not going to want to max him out. Then you might have some other team coming in saying, hey, we've got all this money, we have a hole at point guard, we're going to max you out anyway and hope that you can get back to it. What else are we going to spend our money on? That's maybe when things start to get murkier. Obviously, all the reporting out of there has indicated that he's going to stay. I think most people in Memphis have a confidence in that, but you know, a lot of things can change, right? Like, everyone thought that Rajon Rondo was a fait accompli, he was gonna re-sign in Dallas as soon as that trade was made, right?
Mm-hmm. One other thing I want to mention with this game is that it really swung on a sequence at the end of the third quarter, and so the Grizzlies had cut the lead from 10 points to 5, and so that was, you know, that hasn't happened a whole lot to the Warriors. It's not the first time it's happened to them this season, but then in the last couple seconds, Curry got an and one, made the shot, so then that took it to 7. Then he got a steal and hit a ridiculous, like, 40-foot three. So it went from 10 to 5 to 11. And at that point, it was pretty much over. The crowd was out of it, and that's what Stephen Curry can do.
Yeah, 23 turnovers for the Warriors in this game. I think everyone was saying on Twitter, this is one of those weird games they'll have every once in a while where they're just kicking the ball all over the gym, kind of trying to do too much, but they still scored 100 points on 101 possessions. The biggest and so Memphis can feel happy that they held the number one offense in the league to a point per possession. But when you only score 0.84 points per possession yourself, you're probably not going to win many games. And that's why Memphis is such a terrible matchup against this Golden State team, because they just can't score. At least Randolph and Gasol played a little bit better. Gasol got to the line a ton. So did Randolph. Gasol, I think, was 13 of 14 from the line. But so that's something to look at as a positive for Memphis, but yeah, I don't know. We'll see. I mean, this is a little bit of a step back for them, and ho-hum for the Warriors, just another 16-point win on the road. See you tomorrow back-to-back in Minnesota.
Yeah. Now you want to talk about the main event?
Was it the main event?
I don't know.
I guess, yeah.
It was the last
only
game.
Remaining event. Yeah. yeah, so I thought that this game, LaMarcus is not entirely comfortable yet, but he's kind of getting there a little bit more. And two plays that I thought were illustrative of that. One, where there'd be a pick and roll, and then Parker or somebody, whoever was running the pick and roll, would throw it back to him on his normal pick and pop at the top of the key. And that's normally a shot that he would just shoot all day in his sleep without thinking about it in Portland. And if you're San Antonio, that's an okay shot. It's a mid-ranger, you know, 45% shot. He's a good mid-range shooter. But a lot of times you have a guy on the weak side who's there on the wing for a three. And so one time he hesitated just briefly, but then moved the ball pretty quickly to Green, who drained a three. The second time he kind of hesitated for a second, threw it to Manu, and Manu wasn't able to score. But that's kind of the difference. Those two plays to me encapsulated the difference of playing in Portland, where you are the man, versus kind of being more of a cog in the Spurs machine.
Yeah, and there were times in this game when the Spurs machine looked awfully good. I mean, you have those moments in that. But I think that something you talked about during the game, and it's something that I thought about basically every time I was watching, was what are they going to do with Tony Parker?
Well, yeah, so this is something worth monitoring. Going into this game, because I don't think they've updated yet, Tony Parker has a 0.1 net rating in 183 minutes. Patty Mills has a 22.7 net rating in 149 minutes. And that's, I think there's more mixing and matching between the starters and bench with the Spurs than just virtually any other team. But that's something to watch, right? And when you have all these other talents on this team, the fact that Mills can just space and make threes, and that he's a much better defensive player than Parker is at this point as well. You know, for example, like when Parker was on McCollum, McCollum lit him up. I actually thought Parker was probably better on Lillard, just because Lillard, I would actually say, is not as good of a one-on-one creator just for his own shot necessarily as CJ is. And so I think that's like how CJ was able to get off early on, and then he actually struggled most of the rest of the game. And you know, I think he's going to regress a little bit since he's been shooting unsustainably well from mid-range and on floaters. But yeah, I mean, ultimately though, San Antonio just locked down Portland, and they now, after this game, have the number two defense, only like 1 point per 100 worse than Golden State. And I think LaMarcus is, you know, every bit as good defensively as Splitter was, and he's got more mobility even, and maybe a little bit more shot blocking as well, and certainly more ability to switch on the perimeter. So I think the San Antonio team is going to be a defensive juggernaut no matter what happens with Parker.
Yeah, one other important note in this game, Myers Leonard dislocated left shoulder. I haven't heard anything in terms of a timeline with that.
Yeah, you would have to imagine that's something that's going to be, I mean, it all depends. I think when you have that kind of an injury, you can have like some more severe damage that an MRI is required to see, you know, if there's a labrum tear or something like that, you know, like what the additional trauma is when it comes out of joint, you don't know. But I mean, I would imagine that's probably at least a month injury, if not more. But you know, I'm just guessing there. We can just wait for the report. Let's see what else was there. Oh, everyone who is Spursgasming over Kyle Anderson in Summer League, he is out of the rotation. Rasul Butler is playing over him.
Rasul Butler, the seemingly permanent member of the rotating member of the Spurs family, who's inevitably going to hit a key shot in a playoff series.
Yeah, and Pelton and I were tweeting about this. I had seen it, you know, just in a couple of snaps over when I hadn't been watching Spurs games, seeing number 18 for the Spurs and having no idea who it was. And then I was like, oh, it's Rasul Butler. but yeah, and Butler is a guy who just can shoot threes and isn't going to screw up, whereas Anderson, not that great of a standstill three-point shooter. He takes a long time to get his shot off. And while people sort of think of him as a very Spursy player because he can pass, he had like good statistical translations, everyone's like, oh yeah, Spurs. He actually, I don't think, really fits in that well. Defensively, I think we would agree he's a train wreck,
oh, absolutely.
Right? Yeah, he's really too slow to play anyone on the perimeter and doesn't quite have the explosiveness to play inside. You know, I think you can play him as a, maybe as his ultimate position to me is going to be as a small ball four in bench lineups. But his offensive game doesn't really fit in with what they're trying to do, because for him it's dribble, slow, kind of, you know, get to the elbow, pump fake, shoot a fadeaway. Like, he's not someone who just moves the ball quickly, makes quick decisions at this point in his career, despite the fact that he has some playmaking ability. If the ball is not in his hands doing stuff, his value is really limited. And then when you throw in that he can't defend either, you know, all these reports that they're, like, so high on him and blah, blah, you know, yeah, I mean, every organization is going to say that about someone, and he's had a successful summer league. But I still am unconvinced that he is anywhere near the point where his skills are going to translate into their system very well.
I think you just talked about something that's important. It's a distinction to make with Kyle Anderson, is that he's Spursy and that he's tall, he's very smart, and he's a great passer, and he's kind of quirky, so people like that. But he doesn't play in the way that they do. And so it's kind of one of those, I don't really know the right attributes. Well, it's kind of like where if you see certain things and you try to pigeonhole somebody in a group, but you're not looking at the whole picture. I think that his intelligence and his you know, his vision is great. Like, I think he's a guy who can run an offense for spurts, though his lack of athleticism for basically any position is a problem. Like, he can see things and make those passes. I've actually changed my mind on him with summer league. I thought of him as a small ball four for a long time. I think now he's actually better at an oversized than play him at the two. And so that way he can see over guys and he can do things there. And yeah, he's going to have a speed disadvantage, but really you're splitting hairs. As crazy as it sounds for him, he's kind of equally bad defending a series of positions. So it's just what you think his greatest offensive advantage is. And we're talking too much about Kyle Anderson for an NBA podcast.
Yeah, because he doesn't play.
Yeah,
right.
And you know, no, I don't know. This isn't the time to talk about Kyle Anderson.
I guess not. It was an observation. Yeah, we'll see if he plays summer league for a third year in a row. Maybe that'll be the time. Just kidding. I shouldn't troll too much. UCLA hate there. All right. Well, so today, getting into a little bit of news here before we roll out. Kevin Durant, hamstring strain, out for at least a week, 7 to 10 days. It's good that they're being very conservative on that. Hamstring strains are the type of things that can linger. But crushing news for the Nuggets. And also the Thunder have a pretty easy schedule for these next, like, 5-6 games. So I think there's some hope that they can stay afloat, although, you know, maybe they go 500 or, you know, one game over 500 in that stretch. And in the ever-present battle for seeding in the West, they're kind of falling behind. I mean, to me, so far, based on what I see, Spurs and Warriors way above kind of those next tier of teams. And Oklahoma City's going to have to improve their defense before I can kind of put them in that category.
Agreed. My hope with this is that Anthony Morrow can actually get some minutes, because I still think he might be their best option at the two.
Yeah, see, you know what happened when I called him Anthony Robertson was just my desperate hope that you could somehow combine Anthony Morrow and Andre Robertson into one player who would be, like, exactly what they need. I think that was just sort of like...
And have Deion Waiters' confidence?
Yeah. Crushing news for the Nuggets. They are done. I think at this point now, with any hopes that they were going to kind of contend, get into the high 30s and wins, because Wilson Chandler, season-ending hip surgery, labral tear. He had a labral tear on his other hip.
Yep.
Back about 2-3 years ago. So that's really disconcerting. He is very, very happy, I'm sure, that he signed the extension that he did, which was the renegotiate and extend for 3 years onto this year, and then he bumped him up about $2-3 million or something for this year. That's how Denver used their cap space. We talked about that all over the summer, those machinations. But yeah, that's great. And also, you know, Myers Leonard with his dislocated shoulder, we don't know how bad that's going to be yet. Another guy who eschewed an extension. Supposedly they were talking somewhat seriously about it. He said no. And now, you know, who knows how much they offered him. But if he misses some of the year, we don't know how bad it was, but it looked ugly when it happened. You know, that's why when you say, oh, how could these guys take so much less than their market value? Well, you know, it's not football, but there's still a pretty big injury risk in this sport.
Yeah, and also with Chandler, he'll be 29 next season. And yeah, he has the money there, but you start to think about it, he's had surgery on both hips. I don't know. As soon as I saw it, I just got really down because I started thinking about the kind of the worst case scenarios for him, because I really like him as a player and I think he was such a nice fit for what they're doing. And you hope he makes a full recovery, whether it's speedy or not speedy, and that he can be a part of the Nuggets team next year. That could be a really nice team. That something I talked about with the Magic and also with the Nuggets before this year is I wanted them to kind of have that last stumble to get another piece before they can really run. And I think that could be good for both of those teams, but you don't want it to come this way.
You know who this news is the best for?
Not
the Toronto Raptors.
Now I'm trying to figure out. Oh, because of the pick.
Yeah, they get the worst of New York's and Denver's pick. So, and you know, I guess it's probably not looking, the Knicks are actually looking pretty solid so far, to the point where it looks like they might get into the 30s and wins. But, you know, if something happens with the Knicks as well, I do think that they're going to regress a little bit. Although their defense, as we talked about last night, has been very, very encouraging. I mean, Charlotte has been a good offense and they defended Charlotte really well again tonight. So if their defense is something that they can count on nightly, that really changes everything for them. I thought they were going to be almost certainly one of the worst defenses in the league, and that has not been the case so far. Derek Fisher deserves a lot of credit for that, and their young guys and kind of their unsung guys deserve a lot of credit for that as well, to getting to the point where they can defend at an NBA level. So, you know, maybe it's not going to really end up mattering that much because there won't be a pick swap there. But, yeah, it's, I mean, now you could argue that Chandler being out might be the best thing long-term for the Nuggets, too. They now have a chance at getting another big star in the draft if they end up getting kind of higher. I mean, I don't think they're going to be worst team in the league, but I definitely think, you know, probably under 30 wins, even though they did win tonight in relatively heroic fashion.
Yeah, I think that they're in that mix, and so that means, you know, if they can get a top, let's say a top six pick in this draft, I think that could turn out pretty nicely for them.
All right, anything to plug before we go?
I just released the podcast with Adi Joseph. I think it turned out really nicely. That's on Real GM Radio. And I did the ACS Spotlight podcast, which is also, it's on my Facebook page.
What is that?
It is a podcast I was asked to do. It's a guy in New York. It's actually fun for me because it's mostly, we do talk a lot about the East Coast basketball, which we talk about a lot on this podcast, but since a lot of people know me as more of a West Coast person because that's where we're based, I really have enjoyed watching the Eastern Conference this year, so it was fun to talk mostly.
Yeah, I think the East, last I checked, and this was a couple of days ago, is actually over 500 against the West, which is pretty remarkable. So, all right, for me, I wrote that piece in the Cauldron that I talked to you all about last time, but please check that out. You can follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA, and Danny is Danny LaRue. An iTunes review or rating, something that really, really helps us out. We've been flattered. We've actually been in the top 20 of the iTunes sports rankings, and a lot of that is due to all of your help with the reviews, and that helps us get more sponsors and me not have to go back to the salt mines as a lawyer, which I'm quite enjoying so far. So thank you so much for all your support in making that possible, and also making it possible for me to watch 6 hours of games per day and give you some good content instead of 3 hours of games when I get home from the legal job. So that's all great. And those sponsors, by the way, DraftKings, using the CatSpace code, you can play for free with your first deposit. Or SeatGeek, where you can get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. That's the CatSpace code as well. So Danny, thanks again, as always, for coming on. We will talk to you all next time.